There's probably nobody in history that better embodies the spirit of that song than the Apostle Paul. He's kind of the one we look at like super Christian. Like he had some sort of power from whatever home planet he was born on. Maybe the golden rays of our sun gave him some supernatural ability to obey the Lord Jesus and do his will. In fact, he even says in one point in Corinthians, he's comparing himself to the other apostles. Well, he says, I'm like one born out of time, but by the grace of God, I am what I am. I'm still an apostle and I labored harder than all the others. And even Paul recognizes, yeah, I kind of outdid the other 12, but it wasn't me. It was God working in me. And so while we look at Paul and say, that was something amazing that he did, we also recognize it was something unique. And that's not saying that we can't all be that sold, but it's saying God had a very special purpose for the Apostle Paul. And perhaps that sold-outedness, is that even a word? We'll call it a word. Sold-outedness, if you can think of a better word, please let me know. My wordsmithing abilities are about the same as my wood carving abilities. I told Dan, it's lots of fun to go to those things because it really makes you feel inferior in your capabilities to see what some of these guys produce. I have some skill in some areas, but I could never make what those guys made. Of course, Dan, I couldn't make my own bowed psaltery and play it in church either. So that was amazing. It was amazing grace. It was amazing song, too. And I told Dan, he's going to be upset because I'm going to pick on him for a minute. But I told him Wednesday night, this is the embodiment of what we are created to do. God gives each of us different skill, and we're supposed to use it for him. So whether it's gardening or building lawnmowers or building bowed psalteries, and there's an example of it. And I'm not picking on Dan to say that nobody else is doing it, but to say that he has this skill in woodworking, he makes an instrument which to use in music, which itself is a great gift of God, and he stands up here and plays a song like Amazing Grace. It was just a great demonstration of God's goodness in giving us those gifts to be able to reflect it back to him, and that's what we're supposed to be about. So, all right, Dan, I'm done embarrassing you. And I hope you aren't embarrassed, but just encouraged by it. So that's a great example for us to be following. Paul understands that the grace of God was at work in him in a very, very unique and powerful way in his missionary activities because he is the apostle to the Gentiles. It was through Paul that the gospel went from the very Jewish beginnings in Jerusalem and in Judea and Samaria. Paul's the one that took it to the uttermost parts of the earth. And we've been reading about that as we've studied the second missionary journey, starting way, way back. But well, just to recap our history, the crucifixion happens right about A.D. 30. Saul's conversion in Damascus is probably somewhere around 3 years after that, so maybe A.D. 33, 34. You could place this in 32 if you want to. Most of these dates we're not going to quibble over too much. We're just trying to establish a basic timeline for what's going on in the book of Acts. Cornelius, probably saved 38, 39. And again, that's just basing some of the things that Luke says. He doesn't give us a lot of definitive times, but he'll say this happened and then this continued for some days. And then this happened and something else continued for some days. I actually did a little research, say, Luke, what do you mean by many days? Because frequently he'll say, Paul continued in this city many days and then left. Well, the nearest definite reference I could find is when Paul is shipwrecked in a couple of chapters. And it says, they were without food many days. And then he gives a definitive time reference and he says that they were afloat for 14. So to Luke, many days could mean a couple of weeks. Of course, you know, when you're without food, 2 weeks would seem like many, many, many days. So whether or not, you know, we can account many days as 2 weeks in every instance, probably not. But it does at least help us to put together a little bit of what Luke means when he's giving us some time signatures. So Cornelius saved 38, 39. That is a very big turning point in the history of the church because it shows the gospel definitely going beyond Jewish boundaries. That God's intent in this message of the gospel is to save Gentiles and redeem a people from the Gentiles. just as it is to redeem a people from Israel. Antioch, the church, founded 41, maybe a little before that, but it's definitely by 41 we see definitive activity of a church in the city of Antioch, and it is a definitively Gentile church. And so the church of Antioch is a milestone because it shows us that Gentiles were going out spreading the message already, and they were founding some churches. So not all of the missionary work that happened was at the hand of the Apostle Paul. He's the primary one, but he wasn't the only one. And so this church in Antioch, though it had a Jewish contingent, was also a very, very Gentile place. Right about 48, God separates Paul and Barnabas to go on the first missionary journey, which we traced. He went down through the island of Cyprus and evangelized there. Then he went up to Galatia, went up to Galatia and founded the Galatian churches, traveled through the, it was at Lystra and Derbe and Iconium, and that's where Paul was almost sacrificed to as if he were a god because he healed a lame man, and those struggles of the gospel that he endured in Galatia. It's also the Galatia to which he writes the book of Galatians regarding the gospel by grace through faith. At 49-50, the Jerusalem Council happens because of the gospel spreading to Gentiles. And so the question became more defined. Do Gentiles have to become Jewish in order to be saved? Or, to put it more pointedly, do Gentiles have to undergo Jewish ritual in order to be counted as genuine Christians? And the answer from the Jerusalem Council was, certainly not. Yeah, it wasn't even a calm-hearted no. It was a certainly not. No way, not no how. Think to yourselves the guy denying Dorothy entrance to the Emerald City. Not no way, not no how. That's the emphatic response of the Jerusalem Council. It's trying to settle forever that issue of works-based righteousness. God is accepting the Gentiles on faith, not by works. And we say, boy, we wish that settled that issue forever, but it keeps springing up in the church all the time. We constantly have to fight against this idea of salvation by works. But that's the Jerusalem Council. Shortly after the Jerusalem Council, Paul says to Barnabas, hey, let's go strengthen the churches in Galatia. He's already written the Galatian letter by that point, and so he wants to go see how they're doing. Have they implemented what he wrote to them? Have they defended themselves against this incursion of Jewish works righteousness that was coming against them? That's the fun letter where Paul says, you know, how important is it to stay true to the gospel? Well, what are we supposed to call down upon those that change the gospel? Well, I can agree to disagree with you. You know, I can shake your hand, welcome you as a brother, even though we disagree on this fundamental issue. He says, no, if anybody tries to change the gospel, you count them as anathema. That's cursed. That's condemned. That's judged. There are issues in the Christian faith. Let me be clear on this. There are issues in the Christian faith where we can agree to disagree, where there are real textual issues that we don't fully understand. And we can say, you know, I'm not quite with you on that one, but okay. I still count you as a brother. But it's when you start changing the core of the gospel. We talked about this in Sunday school this morning. The gospel, the death, burial, resurrection of Jesus. You start changing those things. Was Jesus really dead, or did he just swoon? Did Jesus really buried? Was Jesus really buried? Or did he just lie somewhere out on the ground? Was Jesus really raised? Or was it just an apparition to appear that he had been raised? Those are fundamental questions. And Paul even goes on to talk about receiving it by faith. These are the things, this is the gospel in which you stand if you hold fast to that confession. Do you receive the benefits of Christ's death, burial, and resurrection by doing works, or do you receive it by faith? Those are fundamental questions, and people that change those questions change them to their own condemnation. And so we do have to make those kinds of distinctions. But the second missionary journey begins because Paul wants to go throughout Galatia and check on the Galatian churches, make sure they're doing what they should be doing. And that is way out of order, so we'll come back to that. Here's a map of Galatia. I know some of those words are a little difficult to read, but as we retrace the second missionary journey, Paul starts over here in Antioch, and he heads up through Cilicia, visits the churches in Derbe and Iconium and Lystra, and that's where he finds a young man named Timothy. He picks up Timothy, our namesake down here, and carries him along with him along this missionary journey. And so Timothy, to whom the biblical books are written, becomes a protege of Paul. And they are going to develop a very close, very personal relationship over the years. Timothy's going to be an important contingent of Paul's missionary team, because it's Timothy that Paul frequently sends back to check up on churches, to make sure that they're established, make sure they're following in the right way. And so that happens at Iconium and Derbe. Well, Paul tries to go into Asia, and the Lord forbids him. And so then he goes up a little farther to the northwest, and he tries to go in Bithynia, and the Lord forbids him. He says, no, I don't want you going there. Why not? Doesn't the Lord want Paul preaching the gospel? That answer is yes, but he is the Lord of the church, right? He does get to decide where the gospel goes. And so as he's directing Paul's steps, he says, I want you traveling across from Troas into Macedonia to preach the gospel there. So Paul has come to Troas. That's where he has the vision of the Macedonian man. And he sails across the sea to Philippi. At Philippi, he casts out the demon from the python spirit. We've talked about that. From that young lady, and then is thrown in prison. And the jailer gets saved because of Paul's testimony in prison. And there's a church founded in Philippi. So once he founds the church in Philippi, he moves on through Amphipolis to Thessalonica, founds another church there. And really, guys, we're talking about a matter of weeks. He spends a couple of weeks in each place and founds these churches. And so we should all sit back and say, how come it takes our church planters years and years to plant churches these days, right? Because Paul's ministry was unique. God was at work in a mighty, mighty different way than he is today. So don't get down on our church planters who take, you know, 5, 10, 15 years to plant churches in places. It just is a very unique ministry that Paul's doing. So he plants another church in Thessalonica. He goes to Berea. And then he sails down to Athens, where we don't hear of a church being planted, but the gospel is defended in the halls of academia. Paul preaches to the elite school teachers of the day, the professors, the seminarians. Well, they wouldn't have had seminaries, but the professors of the universities of the day. And he defends the gospel very well there. From there, he goes on to Corinth. And that's where we have found him. He spent a year and a half at Corinth. And he's been preaching the word of God according to verse 11. Now, that year and a half of verse 11 could be the total time he stays in Corinth. It could be the time from when he got there unto the Gallio incident, which we studied a couple of weeks ago. And textually, you can take that either way. This is one of those instances where I'm not going to call you a heretic if you think that Paul spent a year and a half and then stood before Gallio and then spent more time. Or if you say, nope, I think the year and a half was the whole time. Textually speaking, it can be read either way. I happen to think that probably Luke is giving us several consecutive events. So Paul has the dream where the Lord encourages him to stay here. I have many people. He spends a year and a half preaching, teaching the gospel, and then the Gallio incident, and then there's a little bit of time afterwards, which we read about in verse 18. So yes, after all that introduction, we're finally to our text, verse 18. After this, Paul stayed many days longer and then took leave of the brothers. So, this time frame means that Paul has spent a significant amount of time in Corinth. If he was able to found a church in Philippi in a matter of weeks, in Thessalonica in a matter of a couple of months, imagine what he's able to do at this church of Corinth. But now, we have studied the Corinthian letters before, and we know that Corinth was a church that needed a lot of work. This church didn't just all come together and start doing things well. It was a church that had a lot of problems, and so in Paul's time there, I'm sure he was dealing with much of that, which is why he needed the encouragement from the Lord to stay put and to keep ministering there. So, it's at least a year and a half that he's in the city of Corinth. Probably in the spring of 52, When the sailing season begins, he starts thinking about leaving. We know that Gallio was proconsul from July of 52 to June of 53. And so Paul was there during that 1 year, and sailing season started early in the spring, and then went till late in the fall. You didn't sail in the wintertime because it was treacherous on the oceans. So once wintertime was finishing up, Paul would have started thinking about his travels and what he was going to do. So it says he took leave of the brothers and set sail for Syria. Now that Syria is his final destination. It doesn't conflict with what we're going to see in just a few moments that Paul stops in Ephesus. Syria is where he's heading. It's where he started. That's where Antioch is. And so he's making his final destination to be Syria. He's going home. So this tells us that Paul knows in his own mind this missionary journey is over. It's time to be finished with it. It's time to return back and report to the church. Because remember, when the church sent him out, they sent him out with some support. They probably gave him some money to go. They want to hear how things are going. It may be that he's been writing some letters back and forth, or they've been keeping up with his Facebook updates. But, you know, they want to hear what's going on. They want to see him in person. So he takes leave of the brothers, and he sets sail for Syria. And with him, this is an interesting thing, with him, Priscilla and Aquila. Now, Paul met Priscilla and Aquila when he got to Corinth. And they're a unique couple because they actually came from Rome. They were living in Rome, and when Emperor Claudius kicked the Jews out of Rome, Priscilla and Aquila came to Corinth, and they set up shop there. They're tent makers by trade. And Paul joined with them, and for a time, he was making tents with Priscilla and Aquila until financial support came from the Church of Philippi and the Church of Thessalonica. And then he was able to devote himself fully to missionary work again. In fact, he talks to the Corinthians about that in the book of Corinthians. Fun read. When you put all these histories together and say, look, these books that we read, these letters, are not isolated. They fit within the framework of these historical narratives. So if you really want a fun challenge, do a little bit of research. Find out about when the letters were written. Start reading through the book of Acts. And when you get to the point when that letter would have been written, go read the letter. And then come back to Acts. And you might, you know, read a couple of verses and then go back and read another letter. And so you can pull all these things together. It's kind of like what we're doing in our evening services when we're studying the books of Kings, but pointing out which prophets were writing at that time and what they were addressing. It really starts to draw the histories together to understand these things are not isolated. So Priscilla and Aquila go with him. They're leaving Corinth. Probably, because of what happens in a few verses, it's probably because they are going with him to start the missionary work at Ephesus. But we'll get to that in just a moment. At Cenchrea, he had his hair cut, for he was under a vow. Now, Cenchrea is, I'm going to have to back up through all these arrows because I put the slide in the wrong place. Cenchrea is the port city of Corinth. We've talked about Corinth being built on this little isthmus. That stretch of land between the two seas is 4 miles wide. Corinth was on the western side of the isthmus. Cenchrea is the port city on the other side. So ships would come in from the west, they would unload their cargo at Corinth, they would transport it across the isthmus, put their ship back in the water at Cenchrea, and then set sail again. And so Cenchrea is an important port city. It was a distinct city. It's kind of like La Salle, Peru. They blend together, but we know there's a line between them somewhere, right? The town I grew up in, Canton, Ohio, is the same way. Where Massillon, Ohio ends and Canton, Ohio begins, you really can't tell. Or the suburbs of Chicago. They all just blend together. But that's the way Cenchrea was with Corinth. It kind of all blended, but it was a very, very distinct town. So he goes to Cenchrea, where he's going to set sail, because that's the port city. Cenchrea is interesting because if you go to Romans chapter 16, verse 1, let's turn there real quick. Acts, then Romans, chapter 16, verse 1. Paul writes the book of Romans quite a bit later than where we're at in the narrative, but Romans 16, 1 makes mention of somebody, and it gives us a little bit of an interesting detail, too. I commend to you our sister Phoebe, a servant of the church at Cenchrea. Isn't that interesting? There's a church in Cenchrea. So in this year and a half or so of Paul's labors in Corinth, he not only founded a church in Corinth, but there's another one founded nearby in Cenchrea. And he commends Phoebe, his servant there. So that just shows us that when Paul went into a city, he wasn't planting just one church there. He was probably working to make sure that that one central metropolitan church then was spreading the gospel into the small towns around. So that explains to us why Paul seems to skip over some towns and stop in the major metropolitan areas. Now, why did he go to Philippi but skip all the little villages around it? Why did he then stop at Thessalonica but skip through Amphipolis? Why does he stop at Corinth and not worry about Cenchrea? Well, he did worry about Cenchrea because he made sure that there was a church planted there. And so the gospel is getting planted in the metropolitan areas, and then Paul is leaving those churches to do the work of spreading the gospel into the rural areas and the smaller connected cities. So he goes to Cenchrea to find a ship heading for Syria. And we have to retrace again all these little arrows. He tries to find a ship heading for Syria, but he cuts his hair. And Luke tells us he was under a vow. And this is another one of those fun instances where, Luke, don't bring these things up if you're not going to give us more detail about them. Now, I'm curious. Anybody else like curiosity killed the cat and you don't care what that statement means? You're just curious, right? It sparks your interest. You say, what is this all about? We know from Numbers chapter 6 that the law prescribed if somebody had devoted themselves to God for a certain time, a Nazarite vow, that at the end of the vow they would cut their hair. They would shave their hair off, take it to the temple, and offer it with an offering. And so this is kind of interesting because we know that Paul's a Jewish man. That would certainly fit together. But we also know that Paul is the one that defends the gospel and says never mix the gospel with these ceremonies. But here he is, he's going to offer this vow. So we say, wait a second, what's going on? On the one hand, when Titus goes to Jerusalem, people want Paul to circumcise him. But Paul says, not on your life will I circumcise this guy. But when Timothy starts to accompany Paul, Paul says, we better circumcise you. So Paul, you inconsistent person. You're such a hypocrite. But you know what makes the difference? What makes the difference is whether or not you're mingling the gospel with works or whether you are adding a ceremony that has some just kind of meaning behind it. So in Timothy's case, he circumcises Timothy to prevent Timothy from being a hindrance to preaching the gospel. In Titus' case, the pressure was, Titus, you're not even a Christian if you don't get circumcised. And Paul says, not on your life will we promote that. Here, Paul is able to say, I'm not mingling this ceremony with my salvation. I'm simply praising God for his goodness, probably because of the vision that Paul had in the night, that dream. Don't be afraid. Nobody will lay their hands on you to harm you, but I have many people in this city. And now it's a year and a half later, and Paul's able to look back and say, he did it. He kept his word. He fulfilled his promise to me. I'm going to offer him a thanksgiving, a praise. And what way would he know how to do that? Well, any Jewish man would know that this Nazarite vow under the law was an appropriate way to offer that kind of thanksgiving and praise. And so the difference is, Colossians 2:16, Paul writes and says, therefore, let no one pass judgment on you in questions of food and drink or with regard to a festival or a new moon or a Sabbath. So when it's a matter of salvation, no, not in the slightest. Don't mingle them. The gospel is of grace. Do you have to perform the ceremonies to be saved? Absolutely not. But when it's a matter of Christian liberty, as a Christian, can you have ceremonies and traditions? Sure you can. How many of you have ceremonies and traditions that are meaningful to you? You put up Christmas trees at Christmas time? It's tradition. All right? You decorate your house? It's traditions. We have traditions here. Every month we do one called communion service, and it kind of looks the same every month. It's very traditional, very ceremonial. We have them, and they're okay. And sometimes they can be very good if you understand that we're not mingling this tradition with the gospel of grace. Do you have to do this in order to be saved? Absolutely not. If you start to think that, then the tradition has become a problem. But If you look at it and say, this is meaningful to me, this helps me think about the salvation that Christ has given me, this helps me draw close to Him, then you can say, yes, they can be good. And so Paul can also write in Romans 14:6, while he wrote adamantly in Colossians 2:16, don't let anybody judge you about keeping these feast days. In Romans 14, he says, therefore, the one who observes the day observes it in honor of the Lord. And the one who eats, eats in honor of the Lord, since he gives thanks to God. While the one who abstains, abstains in honor of the Lord and gives thanks to God. That's Christian liberty. You want to keep Christmas because it helps you think about Christ's birth and what he came to do? Do it. Give praise to God for doing it. Don't judge people who don't. If you don't do it, and you think it's more meaningful not to do it, that's great. Don't judge people who do. This is Christian liberty. So, later on, Paul's going to take another vow at the request of James when he comes back to Jerusalem, because James is concerned that there are some people accusing Paul of just throwing the law off altogether. And Paul takes the vow. And he actually pays for other people to take the vow. And it is, again, because he's trying to remove hindrances from preaching the gospel. We read in our scripture reading, to the Jews, I became as a Jew. To one under the law, I became as one under the law. So Paul would say, in my Christian liberty, I have no problem observing the feast days, observing some of the ceremonies of the law. Now, if it came to thinking you need to offer this sacrifice to be forgiven of your sin, then Paul would say, no, Christ is my sacrifice. Because of Christ, my sin is forgiven. But can I go through the ceremony because it's a meaningful thing? Sure, I can. Christians, we can have meaningful traditions. We can have ceremonies as long as we fully understand that they contribute nothing to salvation. Nothing. Christ did it all. Okay. So, he takes his vow. He cuts his hair. He's going to carry that hair to Jerusalem so that it can be burned on the altar. And according to Jewish custom and tradition, he had 30 days to get there. That's going to be important for what happens here. So, they come to Ephesus, which on our map means they sailed straight across the sea. Well, they probably avoided the islands that were in their way. And they sailed across to the major city of Ephesus. Huge, huge metropolitan area. Very large city. This is where he was forbidden by the Lord to go earlier. When he wanted to go into Asia, Ephesus would have been where he was heading, because it's the capital city of Asia. So he lands there at Ephesus, and it says he left them there. It's talking about Priscilla and Aquila. They are staying in Ephesus. He's going to be moving on. They are probably planting themselves. They are going to set up their tent-making trade to begin preparing the place for the gospel, which tells us that Paul probably is intending on coming back later. Okay? So Ephesus is going to be his next target with the gospel, and Priscilla and Aquila are helping him out. So he's going to leave them in Ephesus. He himself went into the synagogue and reasoned with the Jews. Doesn't tell us how long. Probably it might have only been even one Sabbath day. And so this normal mode of operation for him, he goes into the synagogue, he preaches from the Old Testament prophecies, preaches that Christ is the fulfillment of those prophecies, and he gets a pretty good response from the people here. They don't immediately throw him out of the synagogue, but they say, hey, could you stay longer and tell us about this? We're kind of interested. It says they asked him to stay for a longer period, but he declined. So you got to think through, why would Paul decline an opportunity to preach the gospel? Because he's got to get to the temple. He's under a vow. And this tells us how important it is to keep our word. Jesus say, you know, don't swear by anything. He's not talking about vows there. He's talking about swearing oaths and things. But he says, when you say yes, let it mean yes. When you say no, let it mean no. Paul made this vow, and so he understands it is imperative that he get back to Jerusalem and fulfill this vow. So he doesn't have much time. He's got to sail back to Jerusalem. So he tells them, he declined, verse 21, but on taking leave of them, he said, I will return to you if God wills. And some of your translations, if you have a King James or a New King James, are going to add a phrase in there that says, but I must by all means keep this feast coming in Jerusalem. That little section is kind of an enigma for us because it's in some of the manuscripts, it's not in others. I don't find a problem with it simply because it doesn't contradict anything in the passage, doesn't teach any bad doctrine. You know, say, is it there? Should it be there? Shouldn't it be there? I'm not sure. To me, the evidence looks like about half and half. But if you ask the textual scholars, they're pretty certain it shouldn't be there. But it certainly explains why Paul is in a hurry to get back to Jerusalem, because if he left in early spring, he's trying to get back for Passover so that he can celebrate Passover at the temple and finish his vows of thanksgiving. So he declines this opportunity, and he says, if God wills, I'll return. So he sets sail from Ephesus, and he continues on the journey. When he landed at Caesarea, once again, Luke being incredibly terse in his descriptions, because in those few words, he describes a trip of over 1,000 miles. So it must have been a somewhat uneventful 1,000 miles. The weather must have been good, but Paul just sails right on through. And if we skip to this section where we can see the Mediterranean, he heads south from Ephesus and straight over to the port city of Caesarea. And all that travel is done. He lands at Caesarea. He went up and greeted the church. That term, going up, almost certainly refers to going up to Jerusalem. It doesn't state Jerusalem, but since we know he's fulfilling a vow, and based on that textual variant we talked about, we know he's heading for the temple for the feast. It says he went up, probably to Jerusalem, and greeted the church, and then went down to Antioch. And so from Jerusalem, he heads back to where he began, and that is at Antioch, north in Syria. This completes the missionary journey. So once again, looking at our timeline, if he began in 50, he spent at least a year and a half in Corinth. Counting all of the other ministry that he did, he's probably coming back in 52, perhaps maybe 53, but probably spring or summer of 52, he gets back to Antioch, and he's going to report to the church all the work that he was able to accomplish amongst the Gentiles in Achaia and in Macedonia. The gospel has been firmly planted in Europe, and Paul is able to finish up this time of praising the Lord for his goodness, for his providence, for his empowerment to preach the gospel. So to finish up the missionary journey, we'll summarize that Paul's traveled over 2,700 miles. Not on Amtrak, not on American Airlines, probably not even on a donkey, but Paul's walked most of it. 2,700 miles. And they didn't have bikes yet, Eldon, so I don't think he was biking any of that way either. He spanned about 2 years. He's planted at least 4 churches in Macedonia and Achaia, probably more, because we did read about the church in Cenchrea. He's preached to the common people. He's preached to jailkeepers. He's preached to city leaders. He's preached to the academic elite. He's preached to the demon-possessed. He's preached to the Jew first and also to the Gentile. And so as we finish up this little section, it's a short, terse section. I mean, what we read today covers over 1,500 miles of traveling, probably a couple of months of time. Paul had opportunity everywhere he went to preach the gospel. And I want to ask us this simple question about ourselves. Though Paul's ministry was unique, we're not apostles to the Gentiles. You may not have even been called by God to go do missionary work. I'll set a parenthesis and say, if you think you have, boy, you'd better go. Find out where it is the Lord wants you to be and start pursuing that. But by and large, most Christians, God calls to bloom right where they're planted. Because there's plenty of people right here that need to be reached. And who's going to reach them? You say, well, that's what we pay you for, Pastor. Right? No. I mean, I'm supposed to be out there reaching, just like the rest of us are. But this is the church's work, to be preaching the gospel to every creature that's under heaven, to be making disciples. Paul was able to get to the end of this missionary journey and give this kind of a recount, and I'm betting he did, to the church in Antioch. You know, we traveled this many miles, we preached to this number of people, we saw this happen. You can imagine that missions conference. You say, wow, Paul, you did what? So when we come together on Sundays and on Wednesdays, are we able to recount to each other, hey, look, here's what God did to advance the gospel this week. And it might be something you learned in your devotions this week. It might be something you as a family were able to study together, verses you've been memorizing together. It's something that really stuck out. It might be somebody that at your workplace you had an opportunity to speak the gospel about. We need that encouragement from each other to hear how God is accomplishing the spreading of the gospel through this body of believers. Which also means we need to be purposeful. about spreading it. Paul's very purposeful in this missionary journey. We might not have to travel 2,700 miles, because I guarantee you there's people that need to hear it not more than a mile and a half from here. It would take us 20 minutes to walk it. And are we being purposeful about those opportunities to share the gospel with people that the Lord brings you in contact with? So Dan's going to come and finish us up this morning with one last song. And it's just a song of commitment. Let it be said of us that the Lord was our passion, that with gladness we bore every cross we were given. And so I hope we can sing that with a great deal of sincerity to say, Lord, I want to be called that kind of person. If somebody were to review my life, would they be able to say he finished it well? He finished the course God gave him to do. Now, Paul's not done yet. We're going to read about a whole lot more that Paul accomplishes. But if you look back over your life to this point, would you be able to say, wow, I went this far. I had these opportunities. I was able to accomplish this. And it's all because Christ was working through me and because I was committed to following where he led. Dan, would you come and close us?
As we stand, please.